It's my pleasure to introduce Spencer Greenberg, talking about effective behavior change. So Spencer Greenberg is an entrepreneur and mathematician. He founded Sparkwave, which is a startup foundry aiming to solve problems in the world by creating new software products, including scalable care for depression and anxiety. He also founded clearerthinking.org, which offers free tools and training programs to improve decision making and reduce cognitive biases. So far, these tools have been used by more than 200,000 people. Spencer has a PhD in applied math from NYU with a specialty in machine learning. Previously, he co-founded a quantitative investment firm where he designed algorithms to predict stock prices. His work has been featured by numerous major media outlets such as the Wall Street Journal, The Independent, Fast Company, and the Financial Times. So please submit any questions you have for Spencer via the Bizabo app and join me in welcoming Spencer to the stage.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here. So if you consider humanity's problems from, say, 3,000 years ago, you'll note that many of them have to do with the inability to understand and control the physical world. Things like, how do you get your crops to grow? How do you treat infection? How do you stop the spread of disease? But as science has advanced, increasingly our problems are of a different kind. They involve a substantial behavior change component that makes them different than many of the problems we had before. So heart disease is the number one cause of death worldwide, according to the World Health Organization 2016 figures. Depression is the number one cause of disability worldwide, according to the World Health Organization 2018 figures. Both of these, of course, have significant genetic and environmental components, yet they also can be substantially improved via behavior change. So for heart disease, we've got exercise, diet, and medical compliance that can really help. For depression, cognitive behavioral therapy and behavioral activation are both evidence-based, behavior-based techniques and cognitive techniques. Okay, but even greater than those, with scientific progress, behavior change has actually created a whole new class of threats. And so now we have threats like nuclear war, global warming, and bioterrorism from new viruses. And these are really things that are about behavior fundamentally. So with that in mind, today I want to talk to you about what I'm going to call positive behavior change. So it's behavior change designed to improve yourself or improve the world. Now, if you think about the classic three EA cause areas, global health, animal welfare, and technology risk, one interesting thing we can do is we can try to look at capacities that cut across these three different cause areas. And one of these capacities is evidence evaluation. So this is how do you look at evidence, decide what the evidence says, how strong the evidence is, and I think we can agree this really does cut across all EA work. So for global health, we have things like how much do bed nets reduce malaria, which is an evidence question. For animal welfare, are cage-free campaigns cost-effective for reducing cage use? For technology risk, what do AI researchers forecast about AI development? So this is one capacity that we need in a community that's trying to do good. Another capacity is analytical or philosophical analysis. And so if we think about global health, we have questions like, when forced to choose, should we save children or save adults? Animal welfare, we have things like, are fish, chickens, pigs, and humans equally capable of suffering? And with technology risk, we have questions like, how difficult would it be to control a superintelligent AI? And what I'm proposing today is that there's this third capacity that we talk about a lot less that actually is critically important to many of the things we're trying to do. So this is the behavior change capacity. And in global health, we have questions like how to get people to use bed nets in high malaria areas, which is fundamentally a new behavior we're trying to create. Or in animal welfare, how to get consumers to accept plant-based and clean meat products. Again, a behavior change. Or in technology risk, how do we get AI researchers to deeply consider possible risks of their research? Again, a change in behavior. But behavior change is not just important at the level of causes. It's also really important for you. If you want to have more of an effect on the world, it's really helpful to learn to change your own behaviors to do so. And this also includes if you just want to be a happier person. Being able to change undesirable behaviors can make you significantly happier. Unfortunately, behavior change doesn't happen automatically. Imagine you have the thought, I should really go to the gym every day. Well, I think we all know that just having that thought and even believing that you want to do that is a far cry from actually going to the gym every day. And very likely, it's just not going to happen automatically. But it's also interesting to think about this in a global health context. So how would you go about getting people in rural communities to add chlorine to unsafe drinking water to make it more safe? Well, obviously, you just go and give them chlorine, right? Well, if you ask Evidence Action, they'll tell you that this is not even close to what you have to do to actually create this new behavior. So they actually created educational campaigns to try to get people to use chlorine to make their water safer. And they went into these communities and educated them. But of course, they also need to give them the chlorine. And what they figured out is if you put dispensers right at the places where people are pulling their drinking water, this gives the chlorine for free. It makes it incredibly convenient. It's right there when you need it. It reminds you of using it. So you might think with these two things together, people would engage in this behavior. But no, this is not enough. Turned out they were having this problem that if the dispensers ever got empty, not only would people not being able to use the chlorine, but they found this was substantially associated with people stopping using the chlorine. Maybe this was because people fell out of the habit of using them. Maybe it was because people stopped having faith in the reliability of the chlorine dispensers. So then they went through all this effort to make sure that the chlorine dispensers would always be filled so that they would never go empty. But even that's not enough. They ended up creating this idea of a promoter in a community where they would give people a t-shirt and pay them money to promote chlorine use in their own community. And they studied all these variables associated with which promoters actually do the best job. And even with all of these behavior change strategies, they found that while they could get people to use the chlorine use tended to trail off over time, so people started using it less and less. So hopefully this shows you that behavior change can be a really significant challenge. And so with this, I just want to summarize so far. We have one, that behavior change, positive behavior change, is an important part of most attempts to improve the world today. Two, it can be very hard to do it well. And three, I believe this is significantly under-discussed. We don't really conceptualize ourselves usually as trying to do behavior change, even though I think that is a significant amount of what we're trying to do when we're trying to help the world. Okay, but does it really make sense to talk about improving capacity at behavior change? Is this something that someone could really be an expert in? Well, let's make an analogy to evidence evaluation. I think we can all agree that the organizations that work today improving the world effectively are often good at evidence evaluation. But I think we could also agree that they could still benefit from outside expertise, bringing in a statistician or data scientist or epidemiologist or someone an expert in experimental design. And so we can really think of evidence evaluation as being a capacity that can come in and help groups that are already good at evidence evaluation. And I think the same thing applies to behavior change. You can imagine people who are experts in the psychology of how people change behaviors and what the barriers are to changing behaviors. And they can come help organizations that are already very good at behavior change get even better and figure out new strategies they may not have thought of. A piece of evidence in this direction is that there are these groups like the Behavioral Insights Team, Center for Advanced Hindsight, and Ideas 42 that are behavior change experts. And they've been working with many different nonprofits and government organizations and helping them improve positive behaviors more effectively. And now there have been a series of randomized control trials coming out where they'll actually do studies on their work showing that it creates positive outcomes in a variety of different ways. In my own work at Sparkwave, I see the power of behavior change all the time. Because what we do is we create new companies from scratch that are designed to try to help solve problems in the world through a social science lens. And then if those products are promising, we'll recruit a value-aligned, passionate-driven CEO to work with us and ultimately spin that product out into a new company. And the work we do tends to break into two sides. One is improving people's lives through behavior change, and we do this with our products like Uplift, which is the goal of Uplift is to be the best self-help for depression in the world. And Mindees, the goal of Mindees is to help people who are suffering from anxiety feel better whenever they need it very reliably. And then Clear Thinking, which is a website we created that has more than 20 free tools and training programs to help you make better decisions and understand yourself better. And then a big part of our work is around accelerating the study of behavior change and the study of humans more generally. And for this, we have products like Positly, which is a new platform for recruiting people for studies to try to make it really easy to get the right participants at the right time to do the right thing. And Guided Track, which is a new language for building behavioral interventions and complex studies. Okay, but what can you do to use behavior change more effectively? Well, first of all, as an organization, if you work for an organization or you run an organization, I think it's helpful to very clearly define your behavior change challenges and actually view them as behavior change challenges and potentially even bring in external behavior change expertise to help you with them. Second, as an individual, if you want to change your own behaviors to be more effective or to be happier in your life, or if you work in an organization, I would advocate that you apply behavior change strategies systematically. Okay, but what the heck does that mean to apply behavior change systematically? And I'm going to try to talk about this for the rest of the talk. I'm going to try to make this extremely concrete. So there are a number of different frameworks that have been laid out for trying to create behavior change. I'm going to walk you through some of these frameworks, but at the end, I'm actually going to point you to a new resource that we're just launching today that summarizes all these different frameworks to try to help you get better at behavior change in your own life and in your organization. It tries to make it really easy for you to understand these behavior change principles. So the first framework I want to talk about, this is the framework called the trans-theoretical model. And the idea is that people go through different stages in a behavior change. There's the pre-contemplation phase where they're not yet ready. There's the contemplation phase where they're sort of getting ready, but they're not actually taking actions. There's the preparation phase and so on. And what's neat about thinking about it this way is that you realize that different techniques are appropriate when people are at different stages. And also, you can now conceptualize it as we're moving people from stage to stage by helping them change their behavior. A second framework that I think is interesting is the theory of planned behavior. This says that these three major factors, someone's attitude towards the behavior change, like do they think it's good, do they desire it, the subjective norm, that is, do the people this person cares about approve of them doing the behavior or disapprove, and then perceived behavioral control. Does this person believe that they can actually achieve this behavior? And then these three factors all together influence someone's intention to engage in the behavior, and that ultimately leads to the behavior change. A third really cool framework I want to tell you about is the EAST model by the Behavioral Insights team. And the idea of this is to package some useful behavior change techniques in a really simple to use format that you can use immediately. And so if you're trying to change your behavior, you want to try to make it E for easy by doing things like applying defaults, reducing hassle. You want to make it A for attractive by attracting attention, providing incentives, and other things like that. You want to try to make it social, for example, by showing that most people already engage in the behavior. You want to make it timely, for example, by prompting people at the times they're most likely to be receptive to engage in that behavior. Finally, though, I want to talk to you about a new behavior change framework that we're launching today on our website that's called 10 Conditions for Change, a framework for creating positive behaviors. And so I'm going to tell you about how this works. And again, I'll point you to resources at the end so you can use this for yourself. But we describe it in great detail on our website. Okay, so the point of this, the reason we developed this framework is we want to help you pinpoint exactly why a behavior is not occurring either in yourself or in a population. So you can think of it as analyzing different reasons that are blocking the behavior from occurring so that you can figure out what strategies you can then apply to remove those different blockers. And it's designed to try to be a sufficient model for behavior change. So these different conditions, A, B, C, D, et cetera, we have 10 of them. That's why it's called 10 conditions for change. And the idea is that there's supposed to be sufficient conditions jointly. So if all 10 of them are met, it's very likely someone will engage in the behavior. Now, I should say this is a work in progress. I can't guarantee we won't add an 11th condition later. But right now, we've identified 10 blockers that stand in the way of behavior change. And together, if you meet all of those conditions, the behavior change is likely. Now, what's cool about that also is that if someone's not engaging in the behavior already, that means that one or more of these conditions is not being met. And this allows you to kind of do a diagnostic to figure out which of these blockers are occurring. And the way these conditions are grouped is into these three phases. There's the decision phase, where someone actually has to decide to do the behavior. And as we'll see, we need three different conditions to be met in the decision phase. Then, if you think about most behaviors, they involve taking a series of actions across time. And so we need, for each of those actions, we need these six different conditions to be met. And one way to think about this is that for a given behavior, there's probably a bunch of different sequences of actions that would be sufficient for that behavior. So you want to compare different possible sequences to pick a sequence of actions you think is relatively easy to make occur. And then you got to analyze each of the actions one by one, looking for these six conditions I'm going to talk about for each action. And finally, there's the kind of continuation phase, which is the idea is that after you finish completing an action, and as time passes, some of the conditions that were previously met might start to fail to be met as time goes on and as things change. And so we need to continue those conditions being met. Okay, so let's break this down a little bit more. In the decision phase, we need three conditions to be met so that they've made the decision. We want that the person considers changing the behavior, desires changing the behavior, and intends to change the behavior. And I'll talk about more later what those are. And second, for each of the given actions that make up the behavior, we want that the person remembers to take the action, believes attempting the action will help the goal, chooses to take the action, knows how to take the action, has the needed resources to take the action, embodies the skills and traits needed to take the action. And then finally, in the continuation phase, we need that the person maintains the attributes required to take future actions. okay, that's a lot of information. I'm gonna break this down further, kind of do this recursively. So imagine this is Bob. There's three new behaviors Bob wants to engage in. Bob wants to become a vegan. Bob wants to go to a therapist to treat his anxiety. And also Bob researches viruses. That's what he does for a career. And he wants to make sure he takes societal risk into account when he publishes his research. Okay, so as we said, for each of these behaviors, Bob will be likely to succeed if the 10 conditions for change are met. So let's go through these 10 conditions. We've got the first phase, which is the decision phase. Bob considers changing the behavior. If Bob never even considers changing this behavior, you can imagine it's very unlikely Bob's actually going to change it. So what might this look like? Well, maybe for going vegan, it might look like having a conversation with a friend that gets him to consider it. For going to a therapist, maybe for his anxiety, maybe he sees an advertisement, advertising therapy. For considering taking into account societal risks in Bob's research, maybe he reads an article about the importance of considering societal effects in your research. Next, we need that Bob desires changing the behavior. Now, desires means either kind of an intuitive positive affect around changing it, so very, you know, system one, or it could be a more cognitive system two. All things considered, I think it's better to take it than not take it. And you need at least one of those two things. It's best if you have both, but if you don't, you can imagine that if you don't have either of those, it's very unlikely that Bob is actually going to engage in this behavior. Okay, so what might this look like to help Bob desire this behavior? Maybe appealing to morality around eating vegan, maybe appealing to potential benefits around going to a therapist for anxiety, maybe appealing to consistency for, maybe Bob went into biological research to help people, so why would Bob publish research that might harm society if Bob really has the goal of helping people? Next, we need that Bob intends to change the behavior. And this really means that Bob anticipates that he'll do the behavior at a particular time or in a particular place or over a particular period. Or another way to think about that, if you were trying to make a bet with Bob, would Bob bet against himself or for himself in terms of him taking that behavior? And we can all kind of relate to this where you're like, I really know I should go to the gym. I wanted to go to the gym, but I'm not going to do it right now. I'm too busy in life, you know? And so you don't actually intend to do the behavior. So what would it look like to help Bob intend to do the behavior? Maybe help Bob set a frequency intention. I'm going to do this thing every day. A calendar intention. I'm going to do this thing at a particular point in time. An implementation intention. Whenever X occurs, I'm going to do this behavior. Then we now are at the action phase. And remember that this has to be applied to each action that makes up the behavior, which will usually be a number of different actions. We're going to need to have 6 conditions met. And so first we need that Bob remembers to take the action. You can imagine that if he just totally forgets about taking the action, it's probably not going to occur. This might look like giving Bob calendar reminders or alarm reminders on Bob's phone, or maybe social reminders like Bob's friends or family will remind Bob. Next, we need that Bob chooses to take the action. So this one is really about choosing the action at that moment over other opportunities available. Like, did Bob do the action or did Bob decide to play video games instead at that moment? You can imagine if Bob doesn't choose to take the action, he's probably not going to engage in the behavior ultimately. So for this, we might do things like remove temptation. You know, put Bob in a place where there aren't video games available at that moment when he's supposed to take the action. Or structure procrastination. Maybe Bob can work on this action when he's avoiding doing his taxes. Or visualization of harms. Maybe at the moment of taking the action, Bob can imagine the harms that will occur if Bob doesn't take the action. We also need Bob to know how to take the action. You can imagine if he just doesn't know how to do it, he's probably not going to do it. We could help with this by using memorization, by having Bob conduct his own research on how to do it, by engaging in discussion about how to do it. Next, we need that Bob has the necessary resources to take the action. And this might include a lot of things. It could be money, it could be equipment, it could be a car. Depends on the kind of action that Bob needs to take. You can imagine if Bob doesn't have the necessary resources, well, it's going to be really hard for him to do it. We could help Bob achieve this by stockpiling. For example, maybe Bob could stockpile vegan foods in his home. That might make becoming a vegan easier. Bob might be able to use public resources. Maybe the government offers free therapy in certain cases. Maybe Bob could get grants. So maybe Bob could actually get grants to consider the risk of his research or at least allow the grant to cover that as part of the research process. Okay, almost done. Now we need that Bob believes that taking the action will actually help him achieve his ultimate goal with the behavior. You could imagine that if Bob either doesn't have the sense of self-efficacy, like he thinks that he's not going to be able to succeed at taking the action, or he doesn't believe that the action will really get him to what he's trying to go to, then it's unlikely he's going to take the action. And so here, we could, for example, find people similar to Bob that have succeeded at achieving the behavior by taking the action and maybe describe these people to Bob. Maybe we could provide Bob quantitative evidence of the effectiveness of taking this action towards his ultimate goal. Maybe we could provide Bob with a role model to work with Bob. Ninth, we needed Bob to embody the physical, mental characteristics that need to take the action or the skills needed to take the action. So just all the different attributes you actually need to be able to do the thing. Of course, if Bob doesn't have those attributes, it's very unlikely he'll be able to take the action. And so here, we could have Bob practice. We could put Bob through an assessment to make sure that he has the skills necessary. We could maybe give Bob real-time assistance at the moment when he's trying to take the action, someone to help him. Finally, we're in the continuation phase. Here, we need that Bob maintains all those other conditions we talked about. Because if any of them fall out of place as time passes or after Bob completes certain actions, then Bob's going to probably not ultimately succeed at taking the behavior. And so we could do things like offer a really big reward at the end if Bob succeeds, or help Bob identify problems early on strategically to address which variables are coming out of whack, or maybe Bob can make a public commitment that could help keep those variables intact over time. So, quick summary. We've got these three phases. The decision phase, where we want these three conditions to be met. The behavior gets broken into a bunch of actions. For each of those actions, we want these six conditions to be met. And finally, we want Bob to, if we want the person to continue in the behavior, we need this kind of maintenance condition to be met. Now, I really don't expect you to remember that. That would be crazy to try to remember that. But I just wanted to give you a flavor. We're releasing this framework today, as I mentioned. It's totally free for you to use. You can find it at sparkwave.tech/conditions-for-change. And it walks you in great detail through everything we talked about. And one thing that I didn't go into in very much detail is that for each of these conditions, there's a number of different strategies you could use to help someone if they don't have that condition met. And so if you're thinking about creating a new behavior in your own life or in someone else's life, you walk through the different conditions, figure out which ones may not be met, look at the possible strategies you can use, you can brainstorm other strategies, and that can help you kind of diagnose what's going on. The other thing that I'm excited about is that at the bottom of this website, we've now summarized 7 other behavior change frameworks because we want you to get thinking about behavior change and doing it more effectively in your own work and your own life. And so, you know, use our framework, but also check out all these other frameworks, and they can help you think about how to do it more successfully. So with that, I ask you, go out and make positive behavior change in your own life or the lives of others. The world needs it.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Spencer. So I guess my first question that came to mind when you were running through that is, how did you come to these 10 steps? Like, what was your methodology there?
Yeah, great question. So basically, we did a kind of analysis that I like to think of sufficiency analysis, saying that, you know, if A and B and C and D, et cetera, are all met, this thing will occur. And then we're just trying to systematically try to figure out what all the A, B, and C, et cetera, are. And that's why I say we might end up adding more conditions in the future, but these are all the ones we've been able to identify so far. We also made a database of over 250 behavior change strategies. Mm-hmm. And so as we work to slot those different strategies into these different conditions, mm-hmm. we may eventually see, oh, we're missing something. There's a strategy that doesn't fit in any of these 10, and that will help us identify more. But the basic idea is to try to create, you know, a strong set of sufficient conditions that we can. Of course, I'm not going to say that it's absolutely guaranteed someone will engage in the behavior if all 10 are met, but the idea is that hopefully it'll be very likely that they will.
Mm-hmm. And did you test this out on anyone? So in the kind of...
Yeah, so I've been applying this sort of to different behavior change challenges that I see at Sparkwave. Mm-hmm. This is a really new model, so it's still, you know, it's still early days in development. But already, I think, so a way to think about this is the idea of this is not that it's a model that there's evidence that, you know, this model has been tested and it works. The idea of the model is a way of systematizing your thinking about behavior change to identify what's going wrong. So you can think of it as there's hundreds of possible behavior change strategies. There's a whole bunch of possible behavior change blockers, and we want you to be able to systematically think through them to figure out which ones are most appropriate for your challenge. Mm-hmm. So that's really what the idea of the framework is.
Okay, great. And we've got a question from the audience focusing on helping see change in other people. So, for example, preventative measures like helping a child eat healthily to prevent issues later on in life. So when the motivation or the positive outcomes come later, how does this framework help there?
Yeah, so if you go through let's say you're trying to help a child eat more healthily, you can just go through these 10 conditions and for each of them ask, are they met, right? Has the child considered eating healthier, right? Yes or no? You probably will know that. Does the child desire to eat healthier? Yes or no? And again, that could be sort of a system one intuitive desire, or it could be a cognitive, like the child thinks it's worth it with thinking about it. And as you go through these, you're going to identify a bunch of blockers. I was actually going through someone was talking to me yesterday about helping their friend create a positive behavior, and we were going through this model together, and we noticed that about 5 of these variables were out of whack, and they were like, wow, okay, it's now really clear why the person's not engaged in the behavior, right? And it doesn't mean you're going to work on all 5, but you're going to try to pinpoint the ones that seem the highest leverage, where you think that they're going to get the most, you know, improvement for amount of effort and working on that one.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been working on this generally?
Well, I've been thinking about behavior change now for quite a long time, because our company, to a large extent, is a behavior change company, mm-hmm. and we've been developing this database of behavior change techniques, and so that's where this all began, and that was, I don't know, maybe over a year ago, and then more recently, we've been actually trying to systematize the process and develop all these frameworks and look at the existing frameworks and say, where do we think we can add value beyond what the existing frameworks do?
Mm-hmm. And is this just intended to be kind of a resource for people, or is there like is there a further aim?
No, it's intended to be a resource so that organizations trying to help the world can use it, yeah. and people can use it in their own lives, and also we can use it in our own work.
Mm-hmm. Great. And a question from the audience: in the chlorine example, are there any obvious failure points using your framework?
The which example?
In the chlorine example, but I'm
oh
not
chlorine.
Sure. Yeah.
I haven't actually applied the framework to that specific example. But if you think about it, well, the desire step, the desire condition, well, that has to do with education, right? So why do you need to go and educate people about why the benefits of chlorine? Well, to hit that desire step, right? Mm-hmm. The chooses condition. Well, that's going to be the person's getting to the well, they see the chlorine dispenser, are they actually going to choose to do it at that moment? And again, that's going to relate to the way that if the chlorine dispensers sometimes go empty, people often stop using them. And so maybe what's happening is that by keeping them full all the time, you're helping to promote that chooses step. So at that moment, they don't look at the dispenser and be like, it's probably empty, I'm not going to bother checking. So I think if you break it down, I think you will find that, they kind of slot into those different conditions.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of businesses, do you just see this being applied in exactly the same way of we have this problem working as a team and you go through the steps, or?
You mean internally?
Yeah.
So one thing I want to, I think I'm glad you brought that up, because you could think about some behavior changes about getting an organization to change its behavior or a government. And one way to think about that, there certainly are unique dynamics to a group or to a company or a government. But at the end of the day, it's really people making decisions. And so you can apply this to the level of the individual people in the group. Now, you may not know all those individual people, but you may know characteristics about them. So if you're trying to create a governmental behavior change, well, who are the people who actually have the power? And then you could apply this framework thinking about that person who actually has the power. Or maybe there's 3 people. Same with a company. You could think about, well, okay, are you analyzing the behavior of managers? Well, let's apply this to those individual managers, right?
Mm-hmm. I guess that seems like quite labor intensive. To then go through, if there's a team doing it for every single person.
Oh, no. So the idea is not that you have to do it necessarily for every single person, but maybe every single type of person.
Yeah.
Like, let's say you have a company and you're trying to change the behavior of all the managers at your company, right? Mm-hmm. So you need to think about, you can think of the managers as a class of people. Yeah. And so when you're evaluating these conditions for an individual, you ask a question like, is this condition met, or to what extent is this condition met for this individual? But when you're doing it for a group of people, you'll say something like, well, what percentage of people will strongly meet this condition? Like, are 90% of people already meeting it, or only 10%? So,
mm-hmm. And then just a kind of, I guess, broader question on behavior change. How successful do you find that these kind of interventions are? Like, we probably all wish we went to the gym more and when we've tried these various things. What kind of success rate do you see of people who actually try to implement these things seeing positive changes?
Yeah, this is exactly sort of the point for me, which is that behavior change is really hard, right? So many of us have things we want to do with our behavior that we don't do. It's really, really challenging. And so that's sort of why we designed the system. It's not enough usually to just kind of go with your gut on like, oh, I'll try this, maybe that will work. We want to provide a way to be really systematic. And I think the reality is you're still going to fail a lot, but we're trying to make you fail significantly less. That's the goal. If framework works, that's our goal for it.
Okay, yeah. Awesome. Thanks so much, Spencer. Can you join me in thanking Spencer today?